All right, good morning. It is 10 o'clock, 10:20, 2023. Starting a little bit late here. On Tuesday, July 7th, Chem 3 lecture. And I'm excited because I have not forgotten to hit the record button once. I think I'm actually getting the hang of this, that all of these are being recorded and going up online. And with my faster internet system, everything is going up online faster too, which was pretty nice. I was able to upload everything last night pretty quickly. It still, like I said, it still takes me the time and the editing in order to convert all the files and make that happen. And I start that process as soon as I go into office hours in the afternoon. And while people are actually coming into office hours, I'm working on all those videos and getting those processed and up online. So hopefully that's working. And so let's talk about what we're going to do today. We've got one thing to finish up in chapter four, and then we move on. So we started VSEPR theory, and actually we did quite a bit with VSEPR theory. We went through all the different geometries that I wanted to cover. The last part is molecular polarity. And so really today, that's what we've got to finish in molecular polarity. So sort of the next couple of days, what it's going to look like. And I need to get this screen moved over so I can see our textbook. So today we'll cover 4.6 and specifically looking at molecular polarity. I've got a homework assignment for chapter four and an answer key to put up for chapter four. So that'll go up today as well. I have like two problems left in that answer key in order to get up. So we'll get those up this afternoon as well. So you guys will have that. And then chapter five is advanced bonding theories. We're gonna skip chapter five. And we'll skip the whole thing. So we're not gonna look at chapter five at all. Chapter six goes into composition of substances and solutions and starts with formula mass. .6 is formula mass. What they mean by that is molar mass. We've already done that. And we picked that up and covered that in another place. But they have 6.2, which is determining empirical and molecular formula. And that's where we'll go next. So if you're looking for something to read and you're looking to read ahead, 6.2 is where you want to pick it up and look ahead. And then they do molarities before we start getting into stoichiometry. And that's a little out of order. Usually I like to do molarities when I pick up liquids and solutions, but we can do molarities there. I don't know that that makes the best sense to pick it up there. I'll have to read through those molarities and other solution units and decide if that's really the place and look at how they fit into the book in that spot. But I definitely want to hit 6.2. And that may be all we do in chapter six. I'll just have to see. But today we're going to pick it up at molecular polarity. So let me go ahead and start off on that, dealing with molecular polarity. Okay, in molecular polarity, we're asking a question that is different than we've asked before. What we've asked so far is bond polarity. In bond polarity, we take two atoms, X and Y, and we ask, is the bond polar? And is the bond polar is a definition based on the difference in electronegativity. And this is from table 4.6 in your book. You can use other tables. These all have two sig figs in the table, and we don't track sig figs in terms of actual electronegativities and the difference of electronegativity. We can, but the numerical value is used to decide polar versus nonpolar, and it doesn't come down to a sig figs issue. So when we look at difference in electronegativity, we write it difference En. And we had a formula for that, that we said that the difference in electronegativity is equal to the absolute value of electronegativity 1, or x in this case, minus electronegativity of y. It's just the electronegativity difference of the two elements in the bond. And we had quoted a standard that we said that this was just arbitrary decision that was made that had some dividing lines that were 0.4 and 1.8. So this is the difference in electronegativity. And what we say is that this region between 0 and 0.4 is nonpolar. Between 0.4 and 1.8 is polar. And greater than 1.8 is nonpolar. And if we're looking at this, the dividing lines, the way the dividing lines work is that nonpolar is from zero. Up until and including 0.4. And that polar is from 0.4 up to and including 1.8. And that if it is greater than 1.8, it's ionic.
I'm confused if 0.4 is polar or nonpolar.
That's what we're doing. So when we say 0.4, see the greater than equal to or less than equal to? Yeah. That means that the 0.4 is nonpolar.
Okay.
So we're including that 0.4 in the nonpolar. We're including the 1.8 in the polar. And only if it's greater than 1.8 do we say that it's ionic. So that's why I try to, the table makes it unclear, that's a dividing line. Does it fall, 0.4, does it fall in polar or nonpolar? But when we write it this way, with less than or equal to, then that means that 0.4 being equal to is included in the nonpolar.
Did you accidentally write nonpolar instead of ionic on that arrow?
Yes, thank you. I'm trying to talk and write at the same time. Sometimes that gets tricky. Thank you. Fixed. Okay. So whether or not a bond is polar or nonpolar is fairly simple. We take the difference in the electronegativity, we compare it to the table, and we're good. But what about molecular polarity? How do we determine molecular polarity? Molecular polarity is thought of in this way. If there is no net dipole, then the molecule is nonpolar. If there is a net dipole, and it's greater than zero, then the molecule is polar. So that means net dipole this equals the sum of all the dipole moments. Essentially the sum of the vectors. But how do we do that? How do we even take and add up all of the vectors? That's a complicated thing. learning how to add vectors is a mathematical principle of how do I take a vector that in three dimensions has both a magnitude and a direction and add them together and figure out if there is a net. That's complicated. In 2D, it's easier, but even in 2D, it's not so easy. What is the symbol? The symbol that was the E, this means sum. It means to add up all of the parts, summation, exactly. So instead of trying to add all these up, what we do is we create a flowchart. What's called it's called a dichotomous key. Dichotomous keys are used in biology a lot. I don't know if I can spell dichotomous. I'm gonna look it up because now I want to know. There I go. Okay, so it is D-I-C-H. O-M-U-S, dichotomous key. Actually, it looks like it's O-U-S. Dichotomous key means binary, that you have a yes or no answer. And so we ask a question. We say, does the molecule contain polar bonds? If the answer to that is no, then the molecule cannot be polar if it does not contain polar bonds. So, nonpolar. If the answer is yes, then the molecule may be polar, but we need to ask another question. So the next question that we ask is the molecule symmetrical? So this question, is it symmetrical? What we are saying is it AX3? Let's start off with AX4. AX4, AX3, or AX2? Where all X's are the same. And by that, what we're also saying there is that it is not AX3E or AX2E. Two, we're saying no E's, no lone pairs. If the answer to that question is yes, then by symmetry, dipoles cancel. Meaning no net, meaning nonpolar. If the answer is no, it's not symmetrical, then dipoles do not cancel. There is a net. And the answer is that the molecule is polar. So that's our flowchart. That's our dichotomous key. Does the molecule contain polar bonds? If it does not contain polar bonds, the molecule cannot be polar. Has to have polar bonds in order to be polar. If the answer is yes, it may be polar, but we need to ask the next question. Is the molecule symmetrical? Is it AX4, AX3, or AX2, where all the X's are the same? Not AX3E or AX2E2, no lone pairs. If the molecule is symmetrical and it fits this pattern, then by symmetry, the dipoles cancel and there's no net dipole and the molecule is nonpolar. If the answer to that question is no, it is not symmetrical, it has lone pairs, or not all the X's are the same, then the dipoles do not cancel. There is a net dipole and the molecule is polar. That's basically the way the flowchart is working. To understand when it's symmetrical that the dipoles cancel is a mathematical thing that I have to try to explain. But once we explain it, the flowchart is sufficient. We don't really need to go beyond the flowchart, and I'm never going to ask you to do the math. I'm never going to ask you to show how the dipoles cancel mathematically. So you don't need to worry about being able to do the math, but it's nice to see that the dipoles cancel or how they cancel. And so we show several examples of dipoles canceling or not canceling in various cases and how we can actually apply this. And for the higher geometries, we would need to amend this dichotomous key for some of the higher geometries, because even symmetry, where the X's are the same in some of the other molecules, we would need to be careful about what we include in here in our symmetry for canceling things out and when they cancel and when they don't. So that's another piece. And we don't do that. We leave that for Chem 1A. So we only stick within our geometries of tetrahedral family, trigonal planar family, and the linear family. And we keep it within that framework. Okay, let's see if we can show some examples of how we do this. First off, let me look at, I showed this to the morning group, but let me show how we add vectors. Because it helps to understand how you actually add vectors together. Let's say that I have an XY system, so 2D. This is Y and X. And let's use two vectors, a blue vector that will come out here. And we will add that to a to another vector. That's okay, I can keep the color the same. It comes up this direction. And I want to find out what the addition of the two vectors are. In looking at how to add the vectors together, one of the simplest ways of adding them together is to take and create a box. By taking the two vectors, this piece, the X vector, and placing it right at the tip of the Y vector, and to do the same thing with the Y vector, oops, wrong thing, that was the eraser. Copy this and move it over. And I lost the arrow. I really want the arrow in there. And we line that guy up. And the net vector, the result of adding both of those together, is the diagonal. That doesn't want to quite snap in there. Tricky, it's being a pain. All right, that's close enough. Don't fight with it. And this is the net vector, which is the diagonal between the two. We can see it a little bit more clearly if we use a diagonal. And I can show another example. If I take and add in a vector make it look like this. And I want to add these two vectors together. It's the exact same process. I take the two and I create the box. It's called the box. I think it's called the box method, actually. So we copy the lower one, paste it in, set them head to toe. Take the other one, do the same thing, set them head to toe. We create the box, and the net results in connecting the diagonal. And you could do it in any quadrant. So it doesn't matter what quadrant you're in, you can add two dipoles together and you can get the net dipole or the net vector. And we simply create the box and then add the two together. Mathematically, the reason that this is working, what we're doing, is we're actually taking the X and Y components. So it's like the halfway point between two lines. It is kind of like a halfway point between two lines, a little bit. It's the sum of the X and Y components. So we can look at the net vector. We could do it in another way. Let's take a net vector or a vector that we want to add together in two dimensions. And we'll do it mathematically. Instead of the box method, what we'll do is we'll take a vector that has an X component. And let's say that this X component is that it is coming out to the point here that is, it's easy enough to do it at 1.0. And that for my line here, I'm gonna come out at the point 0.5 comma 1.0. So on my x-axis, I'm at 1.0, and on my y-axis, I'm at 0.5. So I can kind of see what those components are. When I go to add it together, the sum of these two vectors is the result of adding the x's and the y's together. So in other words, what I need to do is I need to take the X component and I need to add the X components together. So that means that what I do is I take 1.0 plus 0.5, that equals 1.5, and the Y components. And add them together. That's going to be 1.0 plus 0. So now I have my X and Y coordinate for the end point of the net vector. So what I do is I come out on the X. If this was 1.0, 1.5 is going to be somewhere right on here. So I need to extend this axis out a little bit. This will be my 1.5. And 1.0 So I'm all the way out here. And that then is my net vector that extends to that point that is 1.5 comma 1.0. And that's that point, and that is my net vector. And you can see how the diagonal box would be created then, and why the box method also works, and why this addition method works. So this is a very simple system. When you have two vectors, in order to find the net, when it's two, I can find the net vector easily. But what happens when I have a molecule, when I have three, or four, or five, or worse yet, three-dimensional, so that I'm not two-dimensional anymore? The process works the same. The process is the same process. We just do it for many more vectors. But we're not going to do that, so don't panic. Let's see. Could I use the box method for an AX3 or only for AX2? No, I could use it for AX3. That goes to your question. Yes, I could use the, I'd have to use the box method twice. I would have to do it for two vectors, get the net, and then take that net and add it to the third vector using another box model. And I could certainly do that, but it's more complicated. So I prefer not to use the box model when I have three vectors that I want to add together. That's the essential answer to that. All right, so let me show maybe a net vector with three different lines. Maybe this will help. Not that I want to do this, because this is tedious. All right, let's say that I have a vector, and we're just going to make nice round numbers. So let's say that this goes up to 1.0. And then let's say that geometrically, I have a small vector, and we'll do them in different colors. Let's say that I have a small vector out here that is going to the point 0.25, comma, negative 0.25. So there's a vector there. And then let's say that I have a vector that is over here that is coming out to this is looking like minus 0.75. And I'm close to that 1.0. Let's call it minus 1.0. So that I have all of the values, and because I was doing it in points, I guess I should do this one in a point too. This was 0, 1.0. So I have my X's and Y's. The X's and Y's all add together, so that what I would do is I would literally take all of the X's and sum all of the X's up. So it is going to be the 0 plus, I'm going to take the 0.25 and add it into there, plus I'm going to take the minus 0.75, that's in red, and I'm going to come out with some net answer here. So this looks like it's going to be minus 0.5. And I'll do the same thing for the Y. So as I'm going through Y, I'm just taking all of the Y components. So the blue Y component was 1.0. And the orange was minus 0.25. And the red was minus 1.0. And I add all those together, and my Y is going to equal a minus 0.25. So my point that I'm going to get, my xy coordinate, is going to equal x minus 0.50, comma, minus 0.25. And that is going to be my net spot. So I need to go and find x minus 0.5, somewhere right in there. And then I need to go minus 2.5, which is someplace right about in here. And that is going to be my net vector. It's going to be very close to the red line, but not as long as the red line. And maybe I need to make that orange and increase its thickness so that we see it clearly. That's my net vector. That would extend out at that point after adding all of those guys together. That's how it would be done mathematically if I had a whole bunch of vectors. But again, I'm not going to ask to do that. I'm just going to ask you to understand how that's done and then to show you some really neat things that happen with the vectors. So going back to this dichotomous key, notice that in this dichotomous key, what we say is that if the molecule contains polar bonds, we ask this question about symmetrical. And we say, if the molecule is symmetrical, it's nonpolar. If the molecule is not symmetrical, it's polar. So why is it that a symmetrical molecule becomes nonpolar? What happens to all the dipole moments when it's a symmetrical molecule? My contention is, let's look at symmetrical molecules. These are AX4, AX3, AX2, no lone pairs. Let's look at the AX2 case. In the AX2 case, I have two dipole moments. This is linear. This is an A that is separated by 180 degrees, which means that I have X out here and X out here, and the dipole moment extends both to positive X and minus X, and there's no Y. So when these two add together, what happens to the net dipole moment when I add them together? Can you guys see that the dipole moment cancels out? And because the dipole moment cancels out, there is no net vector? Those were not straight lines. Come on, Jason. So what I get is no net vector. They cancel. If I look at the AX3 case, let me go to the AX3 case. In the AX3 case, I'm going to get three vectors. This is an A surrounded by three X's, trigonal planar, with 120 degree bond angle. That means that I'm going to get a vector which is going to extend in this direction, one that's going to extend out in this direction at 120 degree angle, and similarly, 120 degree angle out in this direction. And they're all equal in length. But what winds up happening is the X component of each of these, this is the x component here, and this is minus x, and this one here is minus y, and minus y, and y. And what happens is that when you add these two y's together, that was the eraser. When you add these two y's together, they add up to that y. And this x and this minus x, they cancel each other out. These two minus y's cancel out that y, and there's no net vector. That in this case, the net vector goes to zero. And they cancel each other out. As long as all the x's are the same, change an x, make an x into some other element, they don't cancel anymore. How does this work in three dimensions? In three dimensions, when we look at ax4, and I have an a bound now in angles of 109.5 degrees, and it forms the tetrahedral. Well, now what I need to do is I need to think about my system as being a three-dimensional system. And so I have the y, the x, actually that was the z. Z, x, and y. And my dipole moments are going to look like this. I've got one that is going to go in that direction. I've got then others, one that is going to come out towards me in space. Let's put it over here and go down. I've got another one that is going to go back in space and down. And then I have another one that is going to come sort of in the plane with the X, with the ZY plane. I missed it, but I want the ZY plane. So I want to come off over here a little bit. And that's in the ZY plane. And what winds up happening is, if I were to look down at this, and I were to look down the z-axis, looking down the z-axis, what I would see is I would see the xy axis. And in the xy axis, if I'm looking at it downwards, and we call this x and we call this y because that's the way that it's kind of looking as I look down it, what I wind up seeing is the exact same situation that I had right here. What I wind up seeing when I look down at it is I see these three vectors. I don't see this one. This one disappears. I see these three, and these three are oriented in 120 degree bond angles from each other and look exactly like this case. In other words, all the x components of these three cancel out. So if all of the x components of these three cancel out, and then these three add up to little bitty y components, those three z components will add to that positive z component, and they cancel out. In other words, all these dipole moments cancel as well. I don't really want to get into drawing all of this because it's way more than I want to do. But the x's cancel and the y's cancel, and there's no net dipole because of the symmetry and what's happening in three dimensions. And so basically what happens is this idea of having ax4 or ax3 or ax2, the dipoles all cancel in these situations. And as the dipole cancel in these situations, there's no net dipole and the molecule is nonpolar. So what we're saying by these is that if we go and we grab this piece, actually, I'm just going to rewrite it because you guys are trying to take notes and you're trying to keep up with me. So let's just rewrite it. In the symmetrical case, of AX4, AX3, and AX2, All dipoles cancel. And when they cancel, if there is no net dipole, then the net result is not polar. Break the symmetry. And dipoles no longer cancel. There becomes a net dipole, and the molecule is polar. So we can take just the molecular geometry itself, and we can tell whether or not the molecule is polar or nonpolar, just by looking at the symmetry of the molecule and whether or not it has polar bonds or does not have polar bonds. And we don't need to do any other work. We don't need to go through and do the math or draw the XY axis or do any of that. All we need to do is be able to tell whether or not the molecule is symmetrical and whether or not it has polar bonds. And we can then tell whether a molecule is polar or not polar. And I can show you some examples where I have the dipoles calculated. We can actually see those dipole moments and we can look at it for a number of different molecules. But, and maybe we'll do that after the break. And we'll go through and we'll do some examples. And we will decide whether or not the molecule is polar or not. And then we'll look at the molecule online and we'll actually look at the dipole moment. How does that sound? We'll take a break from here. Let's take a break for 10 minutes. We'll come back and we'll do a bunch of examples and show how we can figure out whether a molecule is polar or not. Sound like a plan? We'll use all the tools that we just developed. All right, let's take that break. While we're on that break, I'll put on some music and I'm going to get my specific examples together.
Forever, but I got that too. Those fancy clothes, but these could keep us warm just like those. What about your soul? Is it cold? Is it straight from the mold and ready to be sold? Cars and phones and diamond rings, bling bling, those are only removable things. What about your mind? Does it shine on? Are there things that concern you more than your time? Gone, going, gone, everything gone. Give a damn. Gone be the birds when they don't wanna sing. Gone people, all awkward with their things. Gone. Look at you out to make a deal. You try to be appealing, but you lose your appeal. And what about those shoes you're in today? They'll do no good on the bridges you burnt along the way. Oh, you willing to sell anything? Gone with your hurt. Leave your footprints, we'll shame them with our words. Gone people, all careless and consumed. Gone, gone, going, gone, everything gone. Give a damn. Gone be the birds if they don't want to sing. Gone people, all awkward with their things. Gone. Make me weak. Oh, you're
spaghetti and the claim that she's never missed. You know the one with an ex-lover who she claims to have never kissed. We turned at 20 paces for love is a duel and we stood still last stone. I can't imagine that this is in the best interest of flesh and bone, flesh and bone. Oh, you put it on me. Oh, left me lonely. You put it on me. Put it on me.
Okay, how long was that? I don't know how long I was gone. I was concentrating, and where the heck am I? Where's my, there we go. I don't know if that was 10 minutes or not. I'm going to assume that it was close, but that I need to start writing down when I go on break, so I know what to do. Because if I come back too soon, then you guys aren't with me. I'm not seeing any indication that you're back yet. Are people back? Who's with me?
Yes.
Kerrigan's with me. Anybody else? It's just Kerrigan and I. All right, there's Emily's. Okay, so some of you guys are here. Was that 10 minutes? I don't know how long that was. What time did I start? You guys don't know either. You let me keep track of all of that. All right. They'll catch up. Let's go ahead and start. I got things I want to do. I'm excited now. I have molecules to show, three-dimensional things to do. And I need to turn my camera back on. There I am. Okay, you can see me. So here's what I want to do. I have a set of molecules picked out that I want to sort of look at and see what happens with this symmetry idea. And so examples. And the first one that I want to look at, switch classes because this will be easier. First one I want to look at is CO2, carbon dioxide. And I'm going to shortcut the drawing of the Lewis structures. So I'm just going to draw the Lewis structures. And if we have questions about an individual Lewis structure or where it came from or how I did it, I'll let you guys ask that and I'll backtrack as I need to. Otherwise, I'm going to move a little bit faster so that we can get through the polarity question, as opposed to the whole drawing of the Lewis structure component. The Lewis structure for this molecule is a symmetrical Lewis structure? That is an AX2 linear with bond angles of 180 degrees. That is CO2. And the delta electronegativity, the electronegativity for carbon is 2.5, and for oxygen is 3.5. So the difference in the electronegativity is 3.5 minus 2.5, which is 1.0. And that falls on the polar scale. So the bond is polar. Polar bond. Now we go through and we ask the questions, is the molecule polar? To answer that, we go through those keys. We first say, are there polar bonds? The answer is yes. We still don't know if the molecule is polar. We need to ask the second question. Is it AX2, AX3, or AX4 with all X's the same? This one is also yes, meaning that it's symmetrical. And when it's symmetrical, what we're saying is that the dipole moment that exists, if we think about this as a 1.0 dipole moment, I've got a dipole moment that extends in that direction and in that direction. They both go out 1.0. We can think of one as being negative and one as being positive. And as such, they cancel, because they're pointed at 180 degrees opposite each other. And so they cancel out. So this, they cancel this symmetry. The molecule is nonpolar. Because the dipoles cancel. So this one, the answer is nonpolar. Because the molecule cancels out. We can go and we can see that. I can show you job manager, carbon dioxide. Here's the carbon dioxide molecule, which is perfectly linear. And on the results page, if I zoom in, you can see the dipole moment is listed as 0.000 debye. And it has a little magnifying glass that I can show that, but only when there is a net dipole moment will it show. If it's zero and I click the magnifying glass, it won't show me anything because there's nothing to show. So I'll show you on another one where we actually can see the net dipole moment. So how do we know if there are polar bonds? Autumn, the way that we're knowing if there are polar bonds is by using table 4.6. So table 4.6 what was it? OpenStax. Subjects. Science. Atoms first. Table of contents. Chapter 4. Covalent bonding. And there's table 4.6. Table 4.6 has all the electronegativity values on it. And what we simply do is we look up the value of the electronegativity for the element in question, and then we do the difference. We subtract the two electronegativities and take the absolute value. And if that value falls, where is the scale? They don't do it the same way that I do it. They just have it here written out in terms of bond type, pure covalent, ionic and polar covalent, and they have the values there, but I've been doing it on a number line in order to make it a little bit easier to understand it. But it's the exact same information content, just presented in a different way. Okay, but go ahead.
What do we do if we don't have table 4.6?
You always have table 4.6. Why would you not have that?
I don't know.
It's an open book, open note, everything. You can just go and get table 4.6.
But like in the future.
What do you mean in the future? You mean like when you're taking Chem 1A and you don't have me? You don't have nice?
Yeah, we don't have nice, wonderful teachers like you. What, yeah. Should we memorize table 4.6?
No, it's too much information. No, whenever anybody asks you a question about polarity that requires you to figure out if a bond is polar or not, they will provide you with a sufficient partial component of this table to be able to do the calculation. They have to give you the numbers.
So we always have table 4.6.
Yeah, basically it's always stated in the problem. It's given to you in it's given to you in an abbreviated form within the problem, or information is provided to you in a way that you don't need to memorize this table.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And when I create quizzes and things like that, I'm going to put it on there too. So I will find some way to be able to include the information that you need, even if it is just listing the electronegativities of the individual elements, and then you can make your assessment. What you do need to memorize, what you should memorize, are these values, the 0.4, the 1.8, those values you should memorize.
Heard. Thank you.
Okay, awesome. All right, I am moving back to, not that, my next example I want to do, notability. Okay, so we've done CO2. Let me compare CO2 with SCO. So let's look at SCO. This is carbonyl sulfide. Is the name of this, and the structure looks very much like CO2. It's linear. It's an AX2. It's 180 degrees apart. But we have an SC bond and the OC bond in order to look at the difference in electronegativities. And so electronegativity-wise, if I grab those numbers, sulfur, carbon, and oxygen. Oxygen was 3.5. Carbon is 2.5. Sulfur is on that table, which is now not in front of me because I moved things around. Let me grab it. Sulfur is 2.5 as well. So with sulfur 2.5, excuse me, I got away from my mic, and my mic is pretty sensitive and directional. So if I get too far away from it, it doesn't pick up well. Sulfur is 2.5. That means that the difference in electronegativity for the SC is 2.5 minus 2.5. It's zero. And for the OC, it is the 3.5 minus 2.5, and that is 1.0. And that's polar. So it does have polar bonds. So the molecule does have polar bonds. Asking the second question, is the molecule symmetrical? And what we were asking was, is it AX2 with X's the same? The answer to this is no. And therefore, it has polar bonds. It's not symmetrical. The molecule is said to be polar. Dipoles do not cancel. Essentially, what's happening is when we look at this molecule, we see that there is a pole that sits in this direction that is 1.0, but there's no pole for the other part of the molecule. And so that becomes the net dipole moment. We can go and we can look at that molecule someplace. Here we go. job manager. I need carbonyl sulfide. There it is. So here's the carbonyl sulfide. You can see its linear nature. You can see the oxygen and the sulfur. And when I get the results, you can see the dipole moment, 0.676. And if I click on that, it shows me, not in the best way, but the arrow is pointed towards the oxygen and the plus side is pointed towards the sulfur. And it sits there and it is a little tiny dipole moment that exists in that bond. And so this molecule is polar and has a small dipole moment. So this one, the molecule was polar. And it had a net dipole moment. So the first one was nonpolar, CO2 was nonpolar, SCO was polar. Let's do one more that's sort of in this genre.
Let's Jason, is that not, maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but is it not just because sulfur is like a bigger molecule than oxygen, or a bigger atom than oxygen? It's more complicated than that, right?
It is. It's not the size. It's not that it's bigger. It's that its electronegativity is less. This is not about size. It is strictly about electronegativity.
Okay. Because I remember you explaining the steps in when you were describing the valence electron, like walk up the periodic table. And so
yes.
I guess in my mind, it would make sense that a bigger atom would be always more electronegative, but that's not true.
That's not true. Actually, the bigger atom is less electronegative.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That it is the smaller atoms that become more electronegative. So the bigger the element is, the less electronegative it is. But but that's a complicated reason why that's true. That I don't know that I want to get into right now. But you're right. Mm-hmm. There is a difference in size. However, the difference in size is irrelevant. It is the difference in electronegativity that is really important. And so it is table 4.6 that we need to consult and look at the electronegativities.
So the higher the number, the more electronegative it is?
That's correct. Yes. Okay. The higher the number, the more electronegative. So far what we did is we did two molecules. We did CO2 that had the structure that was a linear structure that was symmetrical. And bonds, polar, molecule, polar. And the bonds were polar, yes. The molecule was nonpolar because the dipoles canceled. Then we had SCO. In this one, we had polar bonds, but this one, the molecule was polar. And essentially what was happening was that here the dipoles canceled. They were equal and opposite. Here there was only one net dipole. And so no net. This one had a net. And that's the difference between these two molecules so far. The one that I want to explore now is I want to explore SO2. Looks a lot like CO2, except its Lewis structure is very different. Its Lewis structure has a lone pair and causes the bond angle to change. So in this, when we look at SO2, sulfur has a 2.5, oxygen a 3.5 in terms of electronegativity. Those are coming from table 4.6. The difference in electronegativity is equal to 3.5 minus 2.5. It's equal to 1.0. So it's very similar to the carbon dioxide in that the dipole moment is the same because sulfur and carbon have the same electronegativity. But these guys point towards an angle rather than being 180 degrees. This one, the geometry is an AX2E. It has bond angles not of 180, but at 120. So what's going to happen with this one is that the dipoles are not going to cancel, and there will be a net dipole. And so yes, it has polar bonds. Is the molecule polar? The answer is yes, it's polar. And the reason is that it is not symmetrical. It doesn't fit the AX2 without the E. The lone pair causes a pushing and a changing of the dipole moments where they no longer cancel. And there comes a net dipole moment. So here we were looking at AX2s for those guys, but this is an AX2E. And AX2E, as long as there are polar bonds, will be a polar molecule. Let's go look at that one, the sulfur dioxide, and see it in three dimensions. Here's my sulfur dioxide. You can see the bent nature. When I take that molecule and look at the results and the dipole moment, look how big the dipole moment is, 4.291. And when I look at that on the screen, you can see the size of that dipole moment and how it's oriented exactly as I've drawn my picture. If we go back to my picture, see how I drew it with the positive end towards the sulfur and extending through the sulfur right through the center, and the partial minus end extending out here towards the oxygens. That's exactly what we're seeing here. Theirs is more exaggerated, but they're also doing theirs based on a calculation, and I'm doing mine based on hand waving. So the size is different, or the magnitude is what we should say. But this is coming from the fact that the bond with the sulfur and the oxygen is 120 degree bond angle. And because the molecule is bent, the dipoles can't cancel, the dipoles add. Does that make sense? Dipoles can't cancel, the dipoles add together because the molecule is not, the dipoles are not in opposition. The dipoles are not 180 degrees apart. They're 120 degrees. All right, so is there a question?
Yeah, do you want us to figure out the X and Y coordinates of the dipole?
Nope, not at all.
Okay.
All I want you to do is be able to figure out whether the molecule is polar or not polar. So basically what we're doing, I'm gonna go up and grab that flow chart. There it is. I'm gonna grab this. And we are going to work from this. So I needed to use the X's and Y's in order to explain it all to you. But once we know how that works, then all we need is the dichotomous key. All we need to do is just take it and follow it in the key. So here's the way the key works. CO2. We know the carbon-oxygen bond is polar. Does the molecule contain polar bonds? Answer is yes. The molecule may be polar at this point. Next question, is the molecule symmetrical? Is it AX4, AX3, or AX2, where all X's are the same? Yes, it's AX2, and both X's are oxygen, so they're the same. So the answer is yes. By symmetry, dipoles cancel, no net dipole, molecule nonpolar, nonpolar. With SCO, are there polar bonds? The answer is yes, molecule may be polar. We go through and we say, is it AX4, AX3, AX2, where all X's are the same? The answer is, in this case, no, because I have a sulfur and an oxygen. They're not the same. Therefore, dipoles do not cancel, and the molecule is polar. Decision made. In this case, go for it.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Is it safe to say that any like center atom or whatever, like main atom that has a lone pair is always going to be a part of a polar molecule?
No, because molecule, right, because the molecule must have polar bonds, right? So if there are no polar bonds, even if there's lone pairs, I never get onto this side of my dichotomous key.
Yeah, that makes sense. Got it.
Okay, so that's a great question. That's a great clarification. So it's not just about lone pairs. So it also has to have polar bonds. But if it has polar bonds and lone pairs, it's polar.
So for the SCO, it did cancel? I mean, poles?
Did not cancel. So what happened with the SCO is that we had polar bonds, but the sulfur and the oxygen are different elements. They will have different electronegativities. They will not cancel. And so the answer here is dipoles do not cancel, and there is a net dipole.
Okay.
So that molecule is polar. And then the last one, sulfur dioxide. Does the molecule contain polar bonds? Yes. Is the molecule symmetrical, such that it is AX4, AX3, AX2, where all X's are the same, not an AX3E or AX2E2? This is an AX2E. It has a lone pair. That tweaks the geometry. That throws us over here, and we say, it does not fit within this category. And therefore, the dipoles do not cancel, and there will be a net dipole, and the molecule is polar. So polarity is really being linked to symmetry. If the molecule is symmetrical, and there are no lone pairs, and there are polar bonds, the molecule will be nonpolar. If the molecule is asymmetrical, or there are lone pairs and polar bonds, the molecule will always be polar. That's the way that it's dropping out. Let me show you a couple of examples, because we stuck in the AX2 and the AX2E. I want to jump to trigonal planar geometries, and then I want to jump to tetrahedral geometries and show you some examples there. Let's do BH3. BH3 is a trigonal planar geometry. It can be written in a couple of different ways in order to demonstrate its flat trigonal planar nature. Bond angles of 120 degrees. The boron electronegativity is 2.0. Hydrogen's electronegativity is 2.1. And so the difference in electronegativity is 0.1. That is nonpolar. That's the bond. The bond is nonpolar. What about the molecule? Is the molecule polar or nonpolar? Let's go back. Does the molecule contain polar bonds? The answer for this molecule is no. The molecule is nonpolar. That's all there is to it. We don't even need to look at the geometry. If the bond is nonpolar, if there are no polar bonds, then the molecule cannot be polar. And we're done. Let's take a molecule that is BF3. BF3 is identical in geometry. The fluorines have lone pairs, but there is no lone pair on the boron. Boron electronegativity is 2.0, but fluorine is 4.0. The difference in electronegativity equals 2.0. That's technically ionic. So the bond is technically ionic, but we're going to ignore that technicality and we're going to treat it in this case.
Why is that technically ionic?
Oh, gosh.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It just hurts a little bit. boron and fluorine, while having a dipole moment that is 2.0, should fall within the ionic category, does not behave as ionic. And when we set up that table, remember that this is a man-made thing with divisions that we artificially put on this that said that this should be polar in the region and this should be ionic. Ionic really means that there are cations and anions and that they dissociate in water, and that those cations and anions show a degree of sharing that we are going to say is not sharing and is really separate cations and anions. Whereas these are partial positive and partial minus, and it's an unequal sharing. This molecule, BF3, when you work with it, does not behave as if it were ionic. It behaves more as if it were molecular. And so despite having a 2.0 difference and technically being ionic, it behaves in solution more as being polar. Why does it do that? I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I just know that it does. I just know that in grad school, I worked with it a lot and I know how it behaves. And based on my usage with it and how I use it and how it operated in solution, that it never exhibited ionic behavior. It always exhibited molecular behavior in solution. And so sometimes maybe there's things that are like gray areas where we can have some crossover that technically, because of the man-made division, we would call it one thing, but its behavior may still be more molecular in that sort of gray area. And I would say that there's a similar sort of gray area in this area too, and that we get things that may behave more polar, and yet they don't look so polar. Less of a gray area over here, much more of a gray area by the time we get to the ionic and the polar. This is a much bigger gray area than is this. This gray area is like tiny in comparison. Okay, so let that go for a second. Let's decide whether or not the molecule is polar.
Okay.
So is the molecule polar? This is an AX3 with no E's. All the fluorines are the same. If we go down that flowchart, the flowchart takes us, yes, there's polar bonds. Is it an AX4, AX3, or AX2 where all X's are the same? Answer is yes. By symmetry, dipoles cancel. Molecule is nonpolar. So this molecule, even though there's dipole moments and they are large, they all cancel each other out. And this molecule is nonpolar by symmetry. Break the symmetry, and we will move to a polar molecule. Let me show you. I don't think I have it calculated, but it doesn't mean we can't do it. I've got borane. There's the borane with the three hydrogens. And I want to build a new, so new, create new job, periodic table, boron, periodic table, fluorine, give it 3, clean it up, and then submit it to calculation, and then I'll do one more. So I want to calculate submit, OPAC, BF3, geometry optimization. Hopefully it won't barf on me. Nope, barfed. Okay, new job. The boron is, I've told you they all have personalities. Boron is a schizophrenic element, and the lower levels of computation have a very hard time working with it because of its schizophrenic nature. So I'm going to take it forward and do a longer job. And I'll have to talk for a second while it does it, but I'll set up the next calculation while I'm doing it. Geometry optimization, routine Hartree-Fock, let it go. And then we'll do a new job and I'll change from the fluorines and we'll put a boron in it. And let's put two fluorines. And then we'll put an element that is not as electronegative. Let's put an iodine. We'll clean that up. We'll submit that to calculation. We'll do the geometry optimization. That should work. This one's done, so we can look at it. Hooray. Okay, here's the one that is the BF3. In the BF3, if I look at the results page, no, come back, results. The dipole moment. Do you see it? 0.0000 dBi. The dipole moment entirely cancels out. Even though these have huge dipole moments, and I can demonstrate those dipole moments in another way. There's a thing that's called partial charges. And I can look at the partial charges and I can see it changes things that are partially negative go red, things that are partially positive go blue. And I can see that between the red and the blue, there was a huge distinction between the partial charge and the fluorine and the partial charge and the boron. But all those individual dipole moments canceled each other out. And when they canceled each other out, the, how did I get here? When they canceled each other out, I got a zero dipole moment. And so this molecule is truly nonpolar. But when I do break the symmetry, oh, and it failed. Why did it fail? That's not nice. Is it going to give me a dipole moment? It's not even going to give me a dipole moment. I went to too big an element. I can fix that. Job manager, new. I know what to do. Boron, fluorine. And let's do hydrogen. This it can calculate. Submit Gaussian geometry routine Hartree-Fock. Refresh. It'll take a second. Might take a minute. Nope, there it is. Okay, now when I go to the results page, look at the dipole moment. I've broken the symmetry. And the dipole moment points towards the more electronegative ends, towards the fluorine ends. And there is a net dipole moment because the hydrogen is essentially the same electronegativity as boron. And so there's almost zero electronegativity difference between the boron and the hydrogen. And that means that those big dipoles between the fluorine and the boron are what is left, and the dipole moment points towards them. And so by breaking the symmetry, I have created a dipole moment in the molecule. I know that was a lot of screen flashing back and forth, so let me show the difference of what we've done here. what we did is we looked at BH3. We looked at BF3. And we looked at BHF2. These all had the lone pairs on them. This was an AX3, an AX3, and an AX3. The dipole moments here were all symmetrical. And the dipoles canceled. In other words, X is all the same. Here, the X's are not the same. I have a little tiny dipole moment, but these guys are all big. And here the dipoles don't cancel. X is not the same. And so this one had no polar bonds. Nonpolar. This one, dipoles canceled. No net dipole. Nonpolar. This one, net dipole, polar. And so we have the differences in the three, and the three structures. I'll let you catch up for a second. I want to throw one more into this.
Will we have time to do H2O? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I can do H2O. H2O would fit with our first set of compounds. So maybe we'll go back and we'll look at that in context with the first set. Let me throw something into this. I'm going to try to keep these on the screen. And I want to look at the next one. I want to look at PBr3. This looks like an AX3, right? Just by its formula, it looks like AX3. Except for the fact that phosphorus is group 5A with five valence electrons. And when I draw its Lewis structure has a lone pair. And so this is actually an AX3E. Not just an AX3. And even though all of the X's are the same, this lone pair breaks the symmetry. So phosphorus is 2.1 and bromine is 2.8. That's a difference in electronegativity equal to 0.7. That's polar. So the bonds are polar. What about the molecule? Is the molecule polar? Think about the flowchart. Does the molecule have polar bonds? Yes. Is it an AX4, AX3, or AX2 where all the X's are the same, not an AX3 or an AX2E2?
It's an AX3E.
It is. This is what it is. So the answer to this question is no. And the dipoles do not cancel, and the molecule is polar. So this molecule down here, this is polar. So we have to be careful. Even though things may formulally look the same, BH3 will look the same as BF3, will look the same as BHF2 and PBR3. But we have to be careful when there are lone pairs that are in the Lewis structure that break the symmetry. Once the symmetry is broken, if there's polar bonds and the symmetry is broken, the molecule is polar.
So should our first step be to like build the Lewis structure to make sure there is no lone pairs?
Yes, always. Your first step is to build the Lewis structure. Absolutely. So stepwise, what I'm doing is, number one, sometimes it's easier to answer the polar bond question. So do the delta electronegativity and ask, are there polar bonds? Because if there are no polar bonds, then the molecule is no polar, is not polar. So you can stop after that stage, and that's easy to do. So you look at the difference in electronegativity, and if the bonds are nonpolar, the molecule is nonpolar. Second step, Lewis structure. Because you can't answer the rest of the question by going through the flowchart unless you know what the Lewis structure is. So the first step, look at the polarity of the bonds. Second step, draw the Lewis structure. Third step, use the flowchart. Okay, there was a question about water. I want to go back up and look at these molecules that we looked at. We looked at CO2, SCO, SO2. Let's take those and put those in context down here. So this was a question about water. CO2, SCO, SO2. H2O. CO2 was symmetrical. SO broke the symmetry. SCO broke the symmetry. SO2 had a lone pair in it and was bent. Water has two lone pairs and is bent. So the difference in electronegativity, hydrogen being 2.1 and oxygen being 3.5, the difference in electronegativity is 3.5 minus 2.1. So that's 1.4. So it's polar for the bonds. And it is an AX2E2 that is bent. Because of that bent nature, if we go and look at it, I think I put it in the Vesper models. Here it is, water. Because of its bent nature, do you want to make a prediction on whether this is polar or not polar before I show the dipole moment?
Polar.
Definitely. Let's look at the results. Dipole moment, 1.860. That's a pretty big dipole moment. And you can see the direction that it points. That it points towards the more electronegative oxygen element. And so that was a good comparison to do with the molecules that we were originally looking at. Why is it a good comparison? Because all of these were sort of two components. We had the carbon and two oxygens. We had the sulfur and two oxygens, two hydrogens and an oxygen. It looks similar in this regard, but they're completely different geometries. Linear, linear, bent at 120, and the water is a bent at 109.5. And so the geometry definitely plays into the molecule being polar. It's one of the things that makes water a super good solvent is its polar nature, is how polar it is. I think I was cutting somebody off that might have had a question. Is somebody jumping in? Okay.
Is SO2 sulfur dioxide?
It is sulfur dioxide.
Is that a gas?
It is. Sulfur dioxide is a byproduct of combustion. It is released from fossil fuels that contain some amount of sulfur. It goes up into the atmosphere, and when it meets moisture in the atmosphere, is converted into sulfuric acid and sulfurous acid. And those two acids rain down and are components of what we call acid rain and the acidification of our environment. They contribute to the acidification of the land and the acidification of the ocean, and they create all kinds of problems. One of the big things that they do is limestone sculptures in Europe. You can see that sculptures from Greek, Roman times and older sculptures are just deteriorated. Same thing with concrete, with modern sculptures, that the acid rain eats away at the sculptures and deteriorates them to a great degree.
Which is why they use limestone filters to filter out the sulfur, right?
The limestone filters, in a way, I think, if they're filtering out the gaseous components, they're filtering out or attempting to filter out acidic components in the water. Yeah. All right. Let me see what else do I need to show you. I haven't done any tetrahedral yet, and I feel like I should do a tetrahedral. One or two. CH3 methane. No, CH4 methane. Lewis structure is C with four hydrogens. Electronegativities of carbon 2.5 and hydrogen 2.1. The difference in electronegativity equals 0.4. It's on the line. But what we said was that polar was greater than 0.4 up and including 1.8, and that nonpolar was from 0 up and including 0.4. So on the line, we take this as being nonpolar. Because it's greater than or equal to. So the bonds in this are nonpolar. That means that without polar bonds, the molecule also nonpolar. Can't have a polar molecule unless you have polar bonds. So if the bonds are all nonpolar, then the molecule is nonpolar. What about if I switch it up and I do CF4? Now, I have that tetrahedral geometry. But my difference in electronegativity is 1.5. Fluorine is 4.0. Carbon, 2.5. So my difference in electronegativity equals 1.5 equals polar. Is the molecule polar?
No.
Why?
Because it's an AX4.
That's right. The dipoles all cancel out. This is an AX4 with all X's the same. And because of that, the dipoles all cancel. Change the formula, though. Let's change the formula to CF3H. Now, having a hydrogen in the molecule and three fluorines. We still have polar bonds because the carbon-fluorine bond is polar. So there are polar bonds. The change in electronegativity for the carbon-hydrogen is 0.4. That's nonpolar. But the difference in electronegativity for the carbon-fluorine is 1.5. So the bonds are polar. What about the molecule? Polar or nonpolar?
Polar.
Polar. The molecule is polar because we have broken the symmetry because it is an AX4, but not all X's the same.
Are the same.
And that means that the dipoles will not cancel. And there will be a net vector.
There's no tetrahedral molecules that have a lone pair on the center atom, right?
It is tetrahedral. For instance, if we look at NH3, it's not that it's tetrahedral, its electronic geometry is tetrahedral, but its molecular geometry is trigonal pyramidal.
Really? That's crazy.
Yeah. So remember that the AX4, AX3E, and AX2E2 are all in the tetrahedral family. They all have the same bond angle of 109.5. But it's the difference between having the lone pair or two lone pairs. Should put the A in there. I was being lazy. So these are all in the tetrahedral family. It's just we give them different names. This one we call tetrahedral. This one we call trigonal pyramidal. And this one we call bent.
Yeah, I remember you going over that.
Yeah, 109.5. It's just, it helps to remind. I mean, that's what we do, is it helps to remind as we keep going through these. There was something else that I wanted to show you, though. Oh, I know what. A multicentered molecule. What about a multicentered molecule? Is a molecule polar or not? How do we deal with it when I have more than one center? What do? Now we've got three different centers in this molecule. So the three different centers are this center, which is AX4, this center, which is AX3, and this center, which is AX2E2. So I have both tetrahedral, trigonal planar, and bent at 109.5 all in the same molecule. And I have both polar and nonpolar bonds. So the CH bond is nonpolar. The CO bond is polar. The C-C bond is nonpolar. But the O-H bond is highly polar. And I could go through and do those all based on the electronegativity values, and we could show the values for each one of those. But I have both polar and nonpolar bonds. Is the molecule polar? Take a guess. Somebody throw it out there. What do you think?
Nonpolar.
Why? Ah, that was the tricky part. You didn't expect me to ask you that.
Would we have to look at the electronegativity of each bond?
Nope. Think back to the flowchart. What was the flowchart doing for us? Eric's saying polar. Anybody else want to agree with Eric? Eric's mic doesn't work so well. So we're not going to ask Eric to explain because he's on a slow internet and it's hard for him to explain. Anybody else want to pick it up and maybe, yeah, you're welcome, Eric. Anybody else want to pick it up and try to explain why this might be polar?
No.
I love that you answered, Kerrigan. That was awesome. Think about the flowchart. In the flowchart, I'm going to go back to it. In the flowchart, what we did is we said, all right, does the molecule have polar bonds? If it was yes, there was a chance the molecule was polar. Then we looked and said, well, did the dipoles cancel or did they not cancel, right? So if the dipoles canceled, then it's not polar. If the dipoles don't cancel, then it's polar. Let's go back to this big molecule.
What this person said, the lack of symmetry.
The lack of symmetry, exactly. It's the lack of symmetry that when you get to a big molecule like this, you can't possibly have symmetry.
Yeah.
And because you can't possibly have symmetry, I don't know who M is, but major score for M. Due to the large size nature of the molecule, we can't have symmetry.
Yes.
And if the molecule is not symmetrical, then it is polar.
Wait, it is polar?
It is.
Okay.
Because it has polar bonds. We have the two polar bonds that are here.
The lack of symmetry does not make it not polar.
No, the lack of symmetry makes it polar.
Lack of symmetry, thank you. Yes, that. Double negative.
Lack of symmetry makes it polar. In other words, what we're saying is dipoles can't cancel. There will be a net dipole. And that means that the molecule is polar. So when we get to these larger molecules, the larger molecules are almost always polar, unless there aren't any polar bonds like this. If I take a large molecule, and I make a large molecule, and that molecule has all bonds that are nonpolar. So this is a molecule that has all carbons and hydrogens. Doesn't matter how big it is, the carbon-hydrogen bond is nonpolar. And because the carbon-hydrogen bond is nonpolar, the difference in electronegativity is equal to 0.4, that's nonpolar. Because there's no polar bonds, the molecule is nonpolar. Even cooler, when we get into big biological molecules, instead of saying is the molecule polar or nonpolar, we have motifs. The molecule in some areas may be polar and other areas may not be polar. And the degree of the polarity allows the molecule to work in certain ways. I have 1 minute and I can show you in 1 minute. This is a soap molecule. This soap molecule has a polar head. And down here, this is a nonpolar tail. The tail is all made of carbon-hydrogen bonds, but the polar head is made of carbon-oxygen bonds, which are polar and have a dipole moment, whereas these have this little tiny thing and really no dipole moment at all. And the way that this soap molecule works is it takes dirt, this thing that we'll think of as being a non-polar, greasy, oily dirt thing, and these molecules surround it by creating a by creating a 360 degree surrounding, I'm having trouble talking and drawing at the same time, of this molecule, of this dirt particle by the soap and dissolving it and carrying it into water, because the molecule has these different motifs. The polar heads like to go with water. And we say these outsides are hydrophilic, and the insides that are nonpolar are hydrophobic. And so they orient themselves in this way. They surround the dirt particle and they lift the dirt particle off, and they dissolve it into water by basically hiding it. This is actually a really good topic, which I don't have time for. Maybe I'll do it another time. Why soap is so important in fighting COVID-19? Because the capsule that is the virus itself is held together by nonpolar molecules. The soap actually breaks the capsid apart. And once the capsid is broken apart, the virus is inactivated and can no longer bind to the spike proteins in the human body. And so it actually very quickly, by using soap, kills the virus, deactivates the virus. Viruses aren't technically alive anyway, but it deactivates it so that the virus can't function and can't do its job. And once the capsid is broken, it's broken. The viral DNA is non-harmful by itself. It is the capsid which allows it to interject it into the cells. The capsid gets broken, and it's done. That's why soap is so important. And it has to do with the nature of soap in being sort of biphasic. It's essentially, it's got a nonpolar component and a polar component. And so as we get to very large molecules, we don't ask the question anymore, is it polar or nonpolar? That's really for a smaller molecule sort of analysis. When we get to large biological molecules, they're polar and nonpolar at the same time, and we look at the motifs. And that is true of enzymes and everything else, that we look at enzymes and we look at the inside of the enzymes and we look at for polar domains and nonpolar domains, and it all stems from recognizing what is polar and what is not polar, and these simple definitions that we're using right now. So there's a much bigger context in the way that this gets used, and a much bigger, broader topic here and a reason to want to learn it. I'm sorry I didn't give that reason to you to begin with, but at least I give it to you at the end. So you've got a reason on why this is important. All right, I'll take any questions, but you guys are free to go. We'll cut it from here. I'll meet with the afternoon class. I suggest we all go get lunch, get out and enjoy this beautiful day. And I'll hang on the line for a few minutes and take any questions anybody wants to ask.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Could you just scroll up to the difference between C and H? It's down after that.
What did I do? Oh, here.
A little further down. Yeah, perfect.
Okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
So, when I'm reading the textbook, there's a lot of really confusing stuff in the textbook. Yeah.
Yeah. Which chapter are you reading?
I'm reading 4 right now. Okay. And I know you said to read the whole chapter.
Yes.
I'm trying to. Okay. And when I've been like going through and doing the homework, I usually end up referencing your lectures and then going and finding like videos online to explain things, and I'm finding the textbook to be very confusing. Should I be able to understand it better?
Yes. Let me look at chapter 4 real quick. I mean, I've looked at all of these. they're fairly in line with what we're doing. Chemical nomenclature is directly in line. The Lewis structures and symbols are in line. Formal charges are exactly what we did. Molecular structure and polarity. The molecular structure and polarity, 4.6. Mm-hmm. 4.6 may throw you a little bit because they go into more detail than what I do on the geometries. I showed that there are geometries for five things around a central and six things around a central. And I said that we were going to ignore those five and six and that those names were going to be unfamiliar because I wasn't going to use them and that we were going to limit our geometries to those things four and below. So the tetrahedral, the trigonal planar, and the linear, those were the three that we were sticking with. So they may have in here some other things in 4.6 that may not look familiar and be slightly confusing.
Okay.
So I can see how 4.6 might get away from you.
Okay.
The other chapters, 4.1 on through 4.5, should be fairly consistent with the exception of resonance. I did a little bit of resonance, but I'm not going to do nearly as much resonance.
Okay.
Is what they're doing. So if you're stuck in 4.5 and it's resonance, go ahead and let that go.
Okay, but everything else I should be able to understand, and I should be able to like do the example problems that they have within the text prior to the problems at the end of the chapter?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I don't see a problem with doing that. Yes, as I'm looking at them, you should be able to do that.
Okay.
With a caveat, and that is that every textbook is different in its readability, in its approachability to students.
Yes.
And I, while I read a textbook and I understand it and I can read it, that doesn't mean that it always reads well to a student.
You're a chemistry teacher.
Yeah, I know, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And that I have found a chemistry book for organic that students enjoy and find readable and find tangible. I have yet to find an introductory book that does the same. And there was compromises in this, in getting this as a free source and trying it out, because an undergraduate book for this class could easily run $200 to $250.
I know.
And I was trying not to do that. And so I made compromises in readability for that.
Sure.
But this is kind of an experiment. And if it's not working, then I would like feedback from you guys to tell me what's not working and what's working so that we can try and adjust it. And I may need to look at those resources, and maybe it's worth it to have a textbook that is more readable and more in line.
I don't think I do find it to be, well, I guess my experience with dense textbooks is that like there's a lot in there and you end up not needing to know everything that's in the textbook, which may be my way of like shortcutting my way through classes, but it's worked thus far.
It does.
And so I guess, I don't know, in the other chapters I've gotten kind of like bogged down a little bit because I'm like, why don't you understand what the book is saying? And then I'll go to your lecture and I'll be like, oh, I didn't need to do that. So I appreciate that it doesn't cost very much money. It costs no money. That's great. But I guess for me, that's why I'm checking in, because I want to make sure that I keep up and keep moving, and I don't want to get like stuck.
Kerrigan, to be honest with you, I have been confused at some of the things the textbook has done, not in its content and what it's giving, but in its inconsistency. For instance, I have seen now a problem type that is called empirical formula, going from empirical formula to molecular formula. I've seen it in two different chapters. It's definitely in the problem sets in chapter 4. And I anticipated because I keep seeing the problem type, I keep expecting to see the content within the chapter. Mm-hmm. And it's not there. It's not there until chapter 6.
Huh.
Which mystifies me why they present problems and have problems that are buried in earlier chapters, and yet they don't cover the content until a later chapter. And I keep running into that, and I have to be careful that I'm not assigning those problems, or if I do, that I make sure that I cover that content before we get to it. And so there's some inconsistencies in this book that I think a publisher would have forced them to reconcile and wouldn't quite have let them get away with, but because it's all by committee, essentially, in the way that this is being put together, and it's edited heavily, constantly, I think that sometimes they lose track of where they've moved material within a lecture, and yet they keep the same problem types, and they're probably not going back and editing the problems as often or frequently as they're editing the text, which is creating problems in the problem sets itself. That would be my guess in the way that they're going through and doing it. And so it's forcing me to have to be really careful about how I'm assigning things and making sure that I'm reading the chapter and understanding the content before I actually go through and make the assignments. And sometimes I'm discovering things that I didn't quite realize as I'm doing the problem set. So now I'm trying to do the problem set and make the answer key before I actually publish the assignment so that everything is consistent. And
that's nice when you do that though.
Yeah, it helps. Yeah. It's good. It's good.
Good.
So I'm almost ready to publish chapter 4 homework. And then what I would say is you can go from that homework and you can go from the answer key, and maybe the answer key will help in explaining some of those topics.
Okay. And so just to make sure that I'm where I need to be, if when I'm looking at the example problems in the chapter, I should be able to do those problems.
You should be able to do those problems. And if you can't, if something doesn't look right, send me an email.
Okay.
Tell me to look at it and say, is this something I should be able to do? I'm struggling with this one.
Okay, thank you.
Give me a chance to answer it quick.
Okay, see you tomorrow.
Okay, see ya.
Bye.
Thanks for the questions.
Thank you.
I just have a quick question just to clarify.
Yes.
So that big CH molecule that you drew.
Yes.
Even if it were polar, the fact that it's not symmetrical would make it non-polar. No, it would make it polar.
That's right. If there was a polar bond in it, the asymmetry would make the molecule polar.
Okay. All right. That's it. Thank you.
Okay. You got it. Okay, guys, I'm going to go get some lunch. I'm going to end the session. And I will see you later.